All right, today we're going to look at some verses that are used to support the idea that we are born sinners, that we inherit a sinful nature from Adam and Eve. According to the majority of professing Christians, it is believed we humans are born with an intrinsically sinful nature that predisposes us to acts of sin. Original sin is defined somewhat differently by different denominations, but the basic idea is that sin is inheritable. We inherit sin from Adam. This is the doctrine of the Catholic Church called original sin. This is Calvinism, the T in TULIP, the acronym of Calvinism, total hereditary depravity. There is not a lot of support for what they say. They like to wrench or pull verses out of their context, and they like to interpret verses that are meant to be read figuratively, literally. It is really a very interesting phenomena to study this doctrine and see how actually how bizarre it really is. The first text I want to look at is an example of really bad interpretation. This is a classic example of how Calvinists love to wrongly apply scriptures universally to people of all times when that is not the case. Psalm 51:5, "Behold, I was shapen in iniquity, and in sin did my mother conceive me." Now those who believe in original sin, those who believe in total hereditary depravity, think that David was saying here that every single person is formed in the womb with a sinful nature, and at the moment they are born, God looks upon them as sinners. It is believed this statement by David shows we all humans are sinners at conception. It is believed that we inherit Adam's sin through the process of procreation. But is that what this verse is teaching? The New American Standard Bible has it a little differently. It says, "Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin my mother conceived me." I think plain reading of this passage is clear. I don't even have to look at the context, although we will. David says he was brought forth in iniquity. He's not saying that iniquity was in him. There's a big difference. He was brought forth in iniquity. He was not saying iniquity is in him or inside of him, or that he was born with a sinful nature. Being conceived in sin is much different than saying sin is actually inside me or sin is in me. David was not born a sinner, but he was born into a world where sin abounds. He was born to parents who had committed sin. The conditions and circumstances in this sinful world make it more conducive to sin. But the fact does not relieve us from any responsibility or remove any guilt from us that we are born into a sinful world. All of us are born in sin in the sense that we are born into a sinful world. Our parents have committed sin. We have a sinful environment. However, we are not born with a sinful nature. Now, the NIV translation messed up this passage, and I do believe the interpreters of the NIV were Calvinists, because they're the only translation that takes the word flesh and translates it sinful nature, which is a really terrible translation. You have to remember this about the NIV translation. It is not an exact equivalent translation from the Greek and Hebrew. It is a dynamic translation. So you have to be careful with the NIV. When they mess up, they mess up royally. All right? This is how they say. Psalm 51:5, surely I was sinful at birth, sinful from the time my mother conceived me. No other English translation that I looked at for Psalm 51:5 translates it the way the NIV does, so that should tell me something about the NIV translation on this passage. Definitely Calvinistic in the interpretation, a Calvinistic slant. I do think we need to look at the passages that surround this verse. This verse cannot be taken as an island unto itself. So let's read the first 10 verses. To the chief musician, a psalm of David, when Nathan the prophet went to him after he had gone in to Bathsheba. Have mercy upon us, O God, according to your loving kindness, according to the multitude of your tender mercies. Blot out my transgressions. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity. Cleanse me from my sin, for I acknowledge my transgressions, and my sin is always before me. My sin is always before me. Against you, you only have I sinned and done this evil in your sight, that you have found, that you may be found just when you speak and blameless when you judge. Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin my mother conceived me. Behold, you desire truth in the inward parts. In the hidden part, you will make me to know wisdom. Purge me with hyssop, and I will be clean. Wash me, and I will be whiter than snow. Make me hear joy and gladness, make me hear joy and gladness, that the bones you have broken may rejoice. Hide your face from my sins and blot out all my iniquities. Create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me. The clear context here is the Psalm of David, and David here is repenting. This is a psalm of repentance, and David is repenting after Nathan pointed out his sin of adultery and murder. And David is distraught when he writes this psalm. He is troubled over his sin, the greatness of his sin, of adultery and murder and conspiracy. That is what he's expressing in this psalm. We also need to ask ourselves, what kind of literature is this? Psalms are written mostly in a form of Hebrew poetry. This verse is a classic example of poetic parallelism, where the second line of the verse is saying the same thing as the first line in a different way. And from what we know about Hebrew poetry, there are many, many figures of speech that are used. A good example of Hebrew poetry is in the book of Job, Job 1:21. Job says, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return." This should not be taken literally, because this is Hebrew poetry. Job is not literally saying that he's going to return to his mother's womb. Okay, I hope we all understand that. So every single word or every single phrase cannot always be taken literally and applied literally. I think that's exactly what we see in Psalm 51:5. David is feeling strong emotions. He is confessing a great sin. He's expressing grief and guilt by symbols and figures of speech all through the psalm. He's using figurative language throughout this psalm. He's pouring his heart out to God, expressing strong emotions. Look in Psalm 51:2. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity. Cleanse me from my sin. The words wash and cleanse cannot be taken literally. David is not asking for a literal bath here, for God to give him a literal bath. They're figurative expressions. In Psalm 51:4, against you, you only have I sinned. Now, did David sin only against God? No, he did not. He also sinned against Uriah and also against Bathsheba. But in this psalm, he is pouring his heart out to God. In verses 6 and 7, he says, "Purge me with hyssop." Does hyssop make us clean? Do we need to use hyssop to cleanse us? No. It's a figurative expression. Notice in verse 8, "Make me hear joy and gladness, that the bones you have broken may rejoice." Now, did David's bones actually be broken? Were they broken by God? Did God break David's bones? No, it's figurative expression. Did David's broken bones rejoice? When was the last time you saw a bone with a mouth and vocal cords? Okay, these are figurative expressions. This is intense figurative language. And I think the same is with Psalm 51:5. David is not saying he was a sinner when he was conceived. That completely contradicts reality, number one, and it contradicts other verses. Babies in the mother's womb at conception cannot be sinners because they have no knowledge of what? Good and evil. So in Romans 9:11, for the children being not yet born, neither having done any good or evil. How can they do good and evil? They're not born. They haven't come to the knowledge of good and evil. Deuteronomy 1:39, and as for your little ones, who you said would become a prey, and your children, who today have no knowledge of good and evil, they shall go in there, and to them I will give it, and they shall possess it. Talking about the promised land. David is not saying he was conceived as a sinner. That is why he committed the horrible sins that he committed. He's not blaming his actions upon his birth. One writer says David was bewailing his failure to express control over human passions he was born with and resist the temptation that was presented to him. David is using strong figurative language, and the figurative language he's using here is an exaggeration. It's called a hyperbole. David is simply relating his innermost feelings inside. He's not teaching the doctrine of original sin or the doctrine of total hereditary depravity upon the whole human race. He's asking God for forgiveness. He's asking God for mercy for his actions. And when people are in a state of grief, they have a tendency to overstate things. And that's what David is doing here. David is saying, I have been sinning against you, God, since I was born. David is saying, against you, O God, have I sinned. It seems as if I have been sinning against you even from the womb. Figures of expression, pouring his heart out. David is saying here that he is a wretched person before God. As far as he can think back, he's been a sinner. Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin my mother conceived me. He's not applying this verse to the whole human race. Can we get anything out of verse 5 where he is applying this verse to the whole human race? How in the world can anyone put this verse on the entire world? I don't know. Those who teach original sin in verse 5 say verse 5 is the state of every human being born. But David here is speaking from what? His own personal experience. Nothing in this verse even remotely suggests that this passage is for all mankind at all times. David's exaggeration does not prove that we are born in sin. And if you take it literal, the verse is really talking about David and his mother. Original sin is not even remotely in the context. Do you see anything in this psalm about Adam and Eve? Is there any mention of the fall of man, the Garden of Eden, in Psalm 51? No. David is writing as a broken man. He's repenting of his sin. He's pouring his heart out to God. He's not saying, I was born a sinner, and that's why I did what I did. No. He is acknowledging his own sin, his own guilt, and repenting. He's taking responsibility for his sins. Now, there's another interesting way of looking at this verse. If you read this verse literally, you have to notice something. Notice the verse is talking about the circumstances around David's conception, not his birth. The sexual union which produced him was an act of sin. The sin committed here was not by David, but by his mother. Very interesting. In sin my mother conceived me. You see what it's saying? In sin my mother conceived me. There's a strong case here that can be presented that David's mother was in some kind of sin when she conceived him. We have no mention of David's mother's name in the Bible. So Psalm 51 could be, in another view, talking about the defilement of David's mother. David is saying that it was his mother that sinned. She conceived him sinfully. And he is describing the guilt of his own mother. Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity. In sin my mother conceived me. Meaning that David's mother conceived him in a sinful relationship. It was her sin, not David's sin. That's a new twist on this, looking at this verse. In my mother, it's his mother, in sin my mother conceived me, he says. Now do you see that, what I'm saying? Now in scriptures, David had two half-sisters. One was Zariah, hope I said that right, and Abigail, I got that right. We see this in 1 Chronicles 2, verse 13 and 16. 13 to 16. Now we know that the father of David was Jesse. But the father of these sisters of David was not Jesse. And we know that because of 2 Samuel 17:25. It says, Abigail, the daughter of Nahash, sister of Zariah, Joab's mother. Okay. So the Bible says Nahash was the father of Abigail and Zariah. And Nahash was an Amorite. We see that in 1 Samuel 11:1. And in 1 Samuel 12:12, it says Nahash, the king of the children of Ammon. He was a pagan king. And we know for sure from Scripture that David's father was Jesse, not Nahash. Nevertheless, the father of David's half-sisters was Nahash. So this could explain why Nahash showed kindness to David in 2 Samuel 10:2. And this also could explain why David's half-brothers treated him the way they did. Do you remember when David came to them? 1 Samuel 16, I think it is, and when he came to give them bread from their father, they treated him in a bad way. And as you remember, in 16, when Samuel came to anoint one of Jesse's sons, David was not included among the sons. And he says, "Well, do you have any more? Like, these aren't the guys. These aren't the guys. Oh, David. Yeah, he's out with the sheep. And he's brought in and anointed. This is just a possibility." Whatever your take on this passage is, as far as that view or the fact that that David is using figurative language, the subject of this verse is not David receiving a sinful nature from Adam. That is clear. It says nothing about David inheriting or having imputed a nature transferred to him. Why? Sin is something we do, not something that we inherit. Nothing about original sin in the context. That's my take on Psalm 51:5. You can further study it yourself. Here's another verse, Psalm 58:3, that the Calvinists and the original sin teachers use. The wicked are estranged from the womb. They go astray as soon as they are born speaking lies. Now, first of all, again, there is nothing in this verse that implies every person ever born receives a sinful nature from Adam. It does not mention Adam. It doesn't mention Adam's sin, nor that men inherit Adam's guilt, our sin. The verse does not say that everyone universally is born wicked. Does it say that? You know, people do this with Romans 3:10. They love taking Romans 3:10. Look at Romans 3:10. They'll just quote this verse. As it is written, none is righteous, no, not one. Aha! See? None of us are righteous. None of us. We're all wicked. We're born that way. But they don't continue to read. They don't continue to read. Let's read the rest of the passage. No one understands. No one seeks God. Does the fact that Romans 3:10 say none is righteous, no, not one, does that mean that no one is ever righteous? That would contradict so many passages where people are actually called righteous. No one understands. No one seeks God. All have turned aside. Oh, that implies choice. Together they have become. They weren't this way before, but they became worthless. No one does good, not even one. Their throat is an open grave. They use their tongues to deceive. The venom of asps and under their lips. Their mouth is full of curses and bitterness. Their feet are swift, not Adam's feet, their feet are swift to shed blood. In their paths are ruin and misery. And the way of peace they have not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes. It is perfectly clear that Romans 3:10 cannot be yanked out of the context, universally applied to every single person ever born. Unconditionally. No. It is a condition. The state described in Romans 3:10 to 18 is a state, a condition that people have chose to become. They have become, verse 12. That implies action on their part. Mankind is not born evil, we become evil. Mankind isn't made evil, we seek out evil. Mankind isn't born aside and unprofitable, we turn aside and we become unprofitable. This is the same with Psalm 58:3. It's not teaching that everyone is wicked unconditionally because that is the way they were born. Look at the context of Psalm 58. It mentions the righteous. Verse 10. I'm screaming this morning because we don't have a mic. So I'm screaming so that it's picked up on this Android. Maybe the Android's sensitive enough, probably is, to hear me. Psalm 58:10, the righteous, see, in the same psalm. It's not saying that everyone is born wicked. It says the righteous shall rejoice when they see the vengeance. He shall wash his feet in the blood of the wicked, so that a man shall say, verily there is a reward for the righteous. Verily he is a God that judges in the earth. Not everyone is wicked. You can't take Psalm 58:3 and say everyone's wicked. In the same context, people are righteous. People are living righteously. So we have to understand that Psalm 58:3 will not make sense if you take it literally. What do I mean? Do infants talk as soon as they are born? How many have ever heard of an infant coming out and start talking and speaking lies as soon as he is born? How can infants speak lies when they don't even understand the difference between good and evil? This must be a figurative expression because it doesn't fit reality. It doesn't make sense. The entire chapter is figurative. Surrounding verses are all poetic. It talks about men being like serpents and death addlers in verse 4. The breaking of the teeth of the young lions in verse 6. Men melting away like running water in verse 7. Bending his bow to shoot arrows. Men passing away as a snail which melts in verse 8. God destroying like a whirlwind in verse 9. All poetic, figurative language. And all of a sudden they take Psalm 58:3 to be literal. Speaking lies indicates age. It means that they have an ability to comprehend. He's talking about adults. They stop their ears in verses 4 and 5. They're old enough to understand. They have teeth in verse 6. Are babies born with teeth? David in another psalm says the complete opposite about birth. In Psalm 22:10, he says, upon thee I was cast from birth. Thou hast been my God from my mother's womb. completely contradicts what we just read. Which is it? Are we born speaking lies? Or was the Lord our God from our womb? Figurative language. John the Baptist, he wasn't born speaking lies, was he? It says in Luke 1:15, he was filled with the Holy Ghost even from his mother's womb. He didn't come out speaking lies, did he? This phrase, estranged from the womb, is a very poetic way of saying that it seems like the wicked began to sin in a very early age. So the verse itself here forces us to conclude the phrase, as soon as they are born, cannot be taken literal. It has to be taken figurative. It's a hyperbole. It's an exaggeration to emphasize a point. The writer is saying in a figurative way that the wicked go astray at such a young age. It seems like they go astray as soon as they are born. That's what he's saying. Now keep in mind, in order for someone to go astray, they first have to be on the right path, right? How can one go astray into sin if he's already born in sin to start with? If you're already born in sin, what do you go astray from? But notice, it's not Adam's inherited sin that makes them go astray. It clearly says they go astray. It is the conduct of the individual that makes them a sinner. David is saying they go astray. That is when they are accountable, when they have the knowledge of right and wrong. They're not born astray, they go astray. It's a choice. That's how I see Psalm 58:3. Let's go to the New Testament. I can't cover every verse. You can study this further, but these are main verses they use. Romans 5:12. Wherefore, as by one man, Adam, in the context here, that's Adam. We all can agree to that. I will agree with the Calvinists on that. This is Adam. We have Adam in a verse. Wherefore, as by one man, sin entered into you and me and everybody. Sin entered into the world, and death by sin. So death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned. Now the first observation of this verse, there's nothing here that says all men inherit a sin nature from the time they were born into the world. Notice the verse clearly says that sin does not enter into people. Sin in this passage enters into the world. That's a huge difference. Huge difference. So by one man, that is Adam, sin entered into the world. Adam is the man that introduced sin into a perfect world. It was the act of Adam that gave men the choice to sin because sin was not present. Sin is now our environment. Our environment is of sin. Temptation, influences all around us towards sin. We live in a world of sin. We're born into a world of sin. We are brought into this world by people that have sinned. We are surrounded by people that have sinned. Sin has truly gone into the world. Sin also, in this passage, introduced death. Death passed upon all men. Now, there's a great controversy on what the word death here means. I personally do not believe that Paul is talking here about physical death. I do believe that we do die physically because of Adam's sin, because we have no access to the tree of life. We've been banned. That's a whole other doctrine that people teach, that we were born immortal. No, the tree of life is what makes us live forever. And We are not born immortal, an immortal soul. That's a whole other doctrine that we will get to this year, the immortal soul doctrine. But we do not have access to immortality. We are mortal beings, and we must face physical death, part of the curse in this world because of Adam's sin. But death here, I believe, is spiritual death in the sense that spiritual death is someone that remains alive, but they're classified as being dead. And the Bible has people like that. Ephesians chapter 2, in verse 1, it talks about being dead in your trespasses and sins. So there is a spiritual death in the Bible, a death that means that we have no relationship with God, that our sins and trespasses come between us and God, and we're considered dead. The reason I believe that spiritual death is mentioned here and not physical death is due to the reason why death in this verse is passed to all men. Adam's sinful nature in this passage is not passed to all men. Death passed upon all men. And you got to love how Paul kind of concluded Romans 5:12. He wanted us to know for sure, make no mistake concerning who is the one that is actually sinning. I love it. He tells us why death passed upon all men in this passage. Notice that all men. You can circle the word men. It doesn't say infants. It doesn't say babies. It doesn't say children. But men. Why has death passed upon all men? He tells you the next phrase. For that all have sinned. Once a person is old enough to know the difference between good and evil, sooner or later they will follow in Adam's path. It doesn't say they sinned in Adam. It says all have sinned. People are sinners because they have sinned. A drunk is a drunk because he drinks. A thief is a thief because he steals. A person does not sin because he is a sinner. It's the other way around. He is a sinner because he sins. We actually become sinners and are held guilty for sin when we decide to participate and conduct our life as sinful. All who choose to sin will become spiritually dead in their sins. Still physically alive, but they're cut off from God. You think these people are alive to God out here? The majority of people in the world are not alive to God. They're dead. Romans 5:12 says nothing about a person's nature that causes his sin. Sin and death is spread to all men because all sin. Adam brought sin into the world, and sooner or later we follow his path. That is what Romans 5:12 is teaching. Now, down in verse 19, the Calvinists continue to go on with their doctrine of imputation or doctrine of inherited sin. And they take verse 19 and they say, for as by one man's disobedience, and I'm gonna side with them, that's Adam. Adam appears again. By one man's disobedience, many were made sinners. Aha! There you go. Right there. They stop right there, by the way. So the original sin crowd interprets made sinners to mean that all men are born sinners because of Adam's disobedience. That's how they interpret that. That men are made sinners involuntarily, unconditionally, automatically because of Adam's disobedience. But then let's go on with the rest of the verse. So by the obedience of one shall many be made righteous. Now we have to interpret that the same way we interpret the first phrase. And the one there, we all agree on, the Calvinists agree, I agree, that is Jesus. But if it is true, then the first part is true the way the Calvinists say, then men also are made righteous involuntarily, unconditionally, because of one man's obedience. So that means everyone gets saved. Everyone ever was born in sin involuntarily. And now that Jesus has come and died, everyone now is made righteous. We have universal salvation. Everyone unconditionally, everyone is now made righteous. Just as everyone was unconditionally, involuntarily made sinners, everybody is unconditionally, involuntarily made righteous because of Jesus. But in the Scriptures, are men made righteous automatically without choosing from their own free will? No. Is righteous involuntary? Is it unconditional? No. The Bible does not teach anywhere that men are made righteous apart from choice. Notice 1 John 3:7, little children, let no one deceive you. Whoever practices righteousness is righteous, as he is righteous. So the truth of the matter is, many are made sinners because they follow the way of Adam. They follow the path of disobedience. They follow his example. They disobey God like Adam. And they are made sinners. Christ, on the other hand, is the one man who displayed for us, who showed us what obedience was all about. We are made righteous when we follow his path, the path of obedience. One writer said, Adam's act brings death. In choosing to follow Adam's path, we die. Jesus Christ's act brings life. In choosing to follow Jesus' path, we live. Another writer says, Adam has provided the circumstances of temptation and the occasions to sin through his leading influence and example. Though each man is the cause of his own sin and is therefore accountable for his sin, far so, his sin only. For his sin only. Adam provided the occasion of sin, while each man is the cause of his own sin. So Adam has made many to sin by his leading, by his influence and example. If you think about it, in the Old Testament, how many times do we read where the kings of Israel made Israel to sin? Many times. In fact, I didn't want to give all the verses, but notice 1 Kings 15:26. He did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and walked in the way of his father. And in his sin, which he made Israel to sin. Does that mean that, like, he forced Israel to sin? Did he pull out all the soldiers and say, all right, Israel, you're going to sin today? Nope. 1 Kings 15:34, he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, walked in the way of Jeroboam, and in his sin, which he made Israel to sin. Nehemiah 13:26, did not Solomon, the king of Israel, sin on the account of such women? Among the many nations, there was no king like him. He was beloved by his God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, foreign women made even him to sin. A person's leading, a person's influence, a person's example is how people are made to sin. But the sin itself is our choice. We choose, we volunteer by our own free will to become sinners. In that passage in Romans 5:19, the key words is disobedience and obedience. If you follow in disobedience, you're following the path of Adam. If you follow in obedience, you're following the path of Jesus. The question we have to ask ourselves is, who's leading, who's influence, whose example are we going to follow? Are we going to follow Adam's? Are we going to follow Jesus? That's what the passage is teaching. It's not teaching that we were unconditionally, involuntarily made sinners, then it would teach that we are unconditionally, involuntarily made righteous. And that teaches universalism, that everyone is saved. Everybody was condemned and everyone is saved. No one goes to the lake of fire. Ephesians 2, we have a passage which mentions the word nature. Ephesians 2, 3. So let's read from Ephesians 2, verse 1. It says, "And you were dead in your trespasses and sins, in which you formerly walked, according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, of the spirit that is now working in the sons of disobedience, among whom also we all had our conversation." The word conversation is lifestyle, conduct. It implies choices. "In times past, in the lusts of the flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature the children of wrath, even as others." Question that needs to be asked here, the Calvinist would say that see is by nature. The question we have to ask is, how? How did they become by nature children of wrath? Paul is not talking about a nature here that we inherited from Adam. It's not even in the context. He's talking about a previous lifestyle that was lived. You were dead. You were past tense. You were dead in your trespasses and sins, in which you formerly walked, that lifestyle, choices, decisions, among whom also we had our conversation in times past, in the lusts of our flesh, fulfilling the desires of our flesh and of the mind. It is clear here the word nature does not mean something that we inherit involuntarily from our parents or from Adam. The word nature in this text has nothing at all to do with what man is by birth. It's not hereditary. It has to do with choice. It has to do with a way of life. A life developed and learned, a learned character. The word nature can describe a man's self-chosen character, a man's self-chosen custom, a habit, a manner of living. That's the word nature. It has to do with a nature that is acquired over a long period of time. They were not children of wrath by birth. They were children of wrath because of voluntary wickedness. The passage uses the word fulfilling, the desires of the flesh. The word fulfill means to give into, to seek after, to submit to the drawing of the desires. To fulfill always implies giving in when resisting and refusing was always possible. Sinful habits that are practiced so much over and over again, they become like second nature. We talked about this. You know, you have people today talk about Sachin Tendulkar and how that he is a natural born batsman. How many have ever heard that before? It's like second nature to him. He's a natural-born batsman. What do people mean when they say Sachin Tendulkar is a natural-born batsman? It doesn't mean that Sachin came out of the womb carrying a cricket bat. And that soon as he was born, he started knocking sixes. We would be foolish to believe such a thing. What they mean is that Sachin hitting that cricket ball, it's so natural to him when he hits the ball. He makes it look so easy, so easy. So the question we have to ask is, how did it become so natural to him? And if you were to ask him this, I'm sure he would tell you the same thing. It's found in one word: practice. Practice. Practice, practice. And that's the same way with sinners. We practice and it becomes so natural to us. So second nature to us. Ephesians 2 has to do with a person's learned character over time. It is a past life of choices and decisions through habitual practice of a certain kind of behavior. Nothing in Ephesians 2 remotely in the context has anything to do with being born sinful or having a sinful nature at birth. Nothing. Now, I want to close up here with this passage, and I promise this subject will be finished next week. Next week the subject will be finished. But in Romans chapter 7, there's a passage. I'm not going to expound Romans 7 this morning because it would take us longer than you have and I have this morning to expound Romans 7. But I want to look at the verses that they say and just show you, obviously, inconsistencies in their interpretation. Romans 7:17, Paul says, "Now then it is no more I that do it, but sin that dwelleth in me." I knew a person in the previous church I belonged to, which they hammered away at total depravity. Total depravity was like the top of their list all the time. All right? Verses like Jeremiah 17:9, Isaiah 64:6, these verses, our righteousness is filthy rags, and on Jeremiah, we're all depraved. No one knows their heart. Jeremiah 17:9. But they hammered away at this, and I knew one person that had written on their, I think it was on their Bible or notebook of their Bible, it says, "I am not my sin." So I asked the person one day, I said, "Well, what does that mean, that you are not your sin?" And they quoted this verse. They said, "Then it is no more I that do it, but sin that dwelleth in me." Meaning that what they were saying, really what they were saying, is saying that the acts of sin they commit is really not them. And they would say it was the sin that was in them. As though all of a sudden there's like a person called sin inside me. God, that's another person inside of us. We've got all kinds of things going on inside of us. We've got a person called sin in there too. Man, it's complex. But a sin that dwells, you know, Mr. Sin, he dwells inside of me. He's the one doing it, not me. It's that guy. It's that bad guy. I just thought that was really bizarre. Even at that time, I thought, I'm sorry, but that's a little bit taking things too far. I even knew a preacher that even taught stuff like this. And today he divorced his wife and he's living with some young girl and saying that it's God's grace that's upon him. And he used to hammer away at total depravity. It's interesting that now where he's at, he's in total depravity. Exactly where he's at. verse 18, "For I know that in me," and Paul puts in little parentheses here, that is in my flesh, "dwelleth no good thing. For the will is present with me, but how to perform that which is good, I find not." So they say, you know, we can't do anything good. We can't do anything good. Because even when I want to do something good, I can't do good. So then they excuse themselves from being good. Because they say, I can't do good. Because when I want to do good, I can't do good. Verse 23, "But I see a different law in my members of my body, waging war against the law of my mind, and making me a prisoner of the law of sin, which is in my members." The law of sin is in my members. You see, that man is in your members, you know? That's a sin. I mean, if you're taking this literally. I mean, they literally, that pastor that I was under, I remember him preaching that sin was in ourselves, in our mortal cells, the cells of our mortal body. That's what he said. And he took passages like this, literally, saying sin was in my members. First of all, I'm not going to go on about the whole Romans 7 thing, about what Paul is saying here. I just want to make some comments. Nowhere in this passage is Adam mentioned again about the sin of Adam. Nothing at all is mentioned about inheriting depravity at birth. The language I think Paul here is using throughout Romans 5, 6, 7, and 8, he uses figurative language throughout. He talks about the old man being crucified. You think that's literal? we have to literally crucify. Some people in the Philippines every Easter think that's literal, and they go get crucified. He talks about being dead with Christ. In order to serve Christ, do we have to literally be dead? So he's using obvious figurative language all through Romans chapter 6, and then he comes to 7. The language here in 7 is not to be literal. Literally dwelling physically inside the cells of our body members, that's not what Paul is trying to say here. We know that sin is a moral choice. It's not a physical substance. It's a moral choice against the will of God. And Paul, after a person knows the will of God and knows right and wrong, I think he's talking here about a person that is giving himself over to sinful desires. He's living and being controlled by selfish passion. You know, this phrase, flesh, that Paul uses. Paul says that sin is in my flesh, he uses the word flesh. I don't think he's talking about the literal body here. And the reason I say that is because of Romans chapter 8, verse 8 and 9. If you take it flesh to be literal, then you've got a problem here. Let's read it. Those who are in the flesh cannot please God. Now, if you take that meaning that those who are in a physical body can't please God, then we've got a problem here. We're Gnostics. All right? But notice verse 9, really a big problem. However, you are not in the flesh. He's talking to the Romans. They're walking around as spirit beings, I guess. I don't know. He says you're not in the flesh. So if you're taking flesh to be literally like a body, then you've got a problem with Romans 8, 9 because flesh can't be physical there. You are not in the flesh but in the Spirit, if indeed the Spirit of God dwells in you. But if anyone does not have the Spirit of Christ, he does not belong to him. I think Paul, when he means by in the flesh, it means that we're no longer living to gratify our fleshly desires. No longer living a life of sin. He's not talking about the physical body, per se. Paul is speaking about spiritual realities here, not physical realities, and he's using language and figures to express these spiritual realities. Whatever Romans 7 is dealing with, I'm not here to expound on Romans 7. I'm just trying to show you the inconsistencies of their interpretation of the sin nature being found in Romans 7. I think Paul is dealing with life under the law of the Jew. If you go back to chapter 7, verse 1, and read down, I think that's what you're going to see. You're seeing the life of a Jew under the law and his struggle. He's not teaching anything about the sin nature being passed down or inherited by birth. That is not what he's expounding in chapter 7. So to yank that stuff out of Romans chapter 7 and use it as a doctrine, I find it absolutely ludicrous and ridiculous. It just doesn't seem right. Paul is not here teaching that sin is in our mortal body for a physical reality. Spiritual reality, absolutely. The flesh craves and desires, the sinful desires and passions, if we live by them, Paul says we will die. So I think that's clear. I'm going to stop here, and I'm going to definitely finish. I don't want to continue here because I don't have time to finish everything I want to say, and I don't want to rush through it. I'm going to finish next week on how we are born. And I want to talk about the age of accountability. What is there an age of accountability? And how do the Calvinists see the age of accountability with their understanding of total depravity, that we are conceived in sin? Even before we're born, we're conceived in sin, according to them. So we'll stop here this morning.